So, okay. Also, just a preface that, like, this is the album that you keep talking about and stuff like that. This is like not the episode. Like, this is the album that you keep mentioning every so often. You're like, Revolve, like, of the great albums. Just,
yes.
Revolve. So I'm just gonna let you. I'm gonna most of the time cede the floor to you, Jerry.
Okay.
So, like, it's gonna be like one of your videos, except some guy's like, "Oh, so what do you think of Tax?"
Remember that record that you bought me like 2 years ago? Well, I just remember that it's sitting in the closet. So I called you up just to tell you I've been meaning to listen to that. I've been meaning to listen to that. Why don't you come over and talk about it? You come over and talk about it.
I mean, the reason that I go back to Revolver over and over again is, you know, like when I was like, I got really into the Beatles and I was like 12 or 13 or something like that. So it was like, I just had this huge Beatles phase. I bought every book I could read and I bought all their music, except I hated early Beatles. I hated the idea. I don't know if I associated with New Kids on the Block or something, because that was big then, like kind of a boy band thing. So Revolver was the earliest album I would allow myself to listen to.
Wow.
And what was cool was I understood something without really understanding what I understood. So it really is the perfect transition point. So Revolver is that transition point. So like Rubber Soul is almost as good, and it still has its sort of feet in the touring Beatles days and the boy band rock star stuff. And it's got a foot in the Sgt. Pepper's Super Freak Out, Lovely Rita, Meet a Maid, all that kind of stuff. And it's sort of like this like perfect moment where they were still all together most of the time, but they were just moving towards just making the best possible songs in the best possible way. So I think that's the sort of spiritual reason why I love it so much.
Yeah, absolutely. But hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Welcome to Ivan Mean to listen to that. I was just waiting for you to stop talking.
Oh, I'm sorry. You shouldn't have invited me on. You've seen my videos, right?
Yeah. But hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Welcome to Ivan Mean to listen to that, the podcast where we go through albums we've been meaning to listen to and use as a conduit to learn about each other and our guest. Yeah, like it's just me this week. The other people can make it, but it's okay because we got one of my favorite YouTubers of all time. Like, what else do I like? I do like Rick and Morty Supercuts. That's pretty good. But other than that, yeah, Sky Fit.
Oh, jeez.
R.I.P. But yeah, we got the host of Professor Sky's record review, and from the desk of Professor Sky, it's Professor Sky Payne, everybody. He's back.
Here I am. And I brought props. You know, I have the album back there. I got little all four Beatles in toy form. So I'm ready to go here. Although I feel bad. I didn't get your email till earlier today, so I didn't have a chance to listen to your Sgt. Pepper's episode.
Oh, that's
so
all right.
You said that you have a Beatles position. So what if I haven't heard it, what is the summary of your shocking Beatles position?
Yeah. So like one of the reasons I started the show like in 2019 is I grew up in high school and I see, I'm not the language professor of any language, but it's like I grew up in high school and I didn't know any I had like this MP3 player that had like, it wasn't an iPhone or an iPod or anything, like it was like some knockoff thing. It wasn't even a Zune. It was like some knockoff thing. And I would watch like old episodes of The Simpsons on it. It was like a 1-inch screen. I watch old episodes of The Simpsons and Arrested Development on it.
Awesome.
And Community. And I would also like, I would have like every song I've ever heard on it. You know, every like junior year of high school, every song I've ever heard, like Californication was on it. Mm-hmm. Just like some Childish Gambino songs I liked were on it. Like, you know, Eminem was on it. Like I wasn't like an album guy back then. I was just like literally just any song I've ever heard, I put in that
right.
And, you know, a few of the Beatles songs were on there. Like, I remember All You Need Was Love is on there. I remember that was on there. And so when I started the podcast, like in 2019, like I think post college, I didn't know a lot of I think like the first album we did, the second album we did was Abbey Road. And that's the last one. And like that was probably not a very good starting point. I just knew the cover. I didn't know anything about it. And so I was like, this is weird. And then we went to the first album and like, this is boring and boring and insipid and stuff like that. And then like that kind of informed a relatively like not negative, because like I loved a lot of songs they did, but like it was kind of like, what is this? Why is this the band that everyone loves and stuff like that? And then it was kind of like doing we do like yearly Beatles episodes, and it's kind of like Goldilocks, where I'm like, this one's too weird and artsy, and this one's too like this one's too like church boy band, and this one's too like Sergeant Pepper we listened to last year. I loved that. And then this right. one is like kind of like, okay, it's a step back from that, but it's still like but Grace Spellman said this is her favorite, that Revolver is her favorite one. And then you said this is your favorite one. So it was like kind of that. So it was like really, that's the start right. of it. That's like where my Beatles journey.
Well, it's interesting because there's been a shift. It used to be that everyone said that Sgt. Pepper's was their best album. Like that, when I was younger, that was the consensus. In the last probably 10, 15 years, that's shifted. And now Revolver is the consensus. So it's funny. I wonder if I had grown up during this time, if I would have actually been enough of a contrarian and been like, oh, I've had Revolver shoved down my throat this whole time. I need to listen to, to Sgt. Pepper's, the less known album. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably a generational thing because, you know, the boomers are still much more active. When I was younger, and they just will not shut up about that album, about Sgt. Pepper's. They just so
let's talk a little more specific, like more deeper into your Beatles history. Now, you said in one of your videos that you were 23 years old when like the Ed Sullivan Show was on, and you watched that live, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's I was 33, but close enough. But, okay. Yeah, we just got rid of the Victrola. Yeah, no, so. My parents are exactly the age of the Beatles. So the Beatles are all born between 40 and 43. And my dad was 1940 and my mom was 42. So they're not quite boomers. They're a little bit older than that. So, you know, my parents saw them perform at Carnegie Hall, like back in 63 or whatever it was. They said it was just terrible. It was just screaming, you know, it was interesting, you know, to watch all the dust like flying up from the balcony. That's the way my dad would describe it. And you know, so I thought all the 60s, you know, I was born in 77. So I missed all that. Apparently the first movie I ever saw, they took me to a drive-in of Yellow Submarine, which is probably why Yellow Submarine is like still one of my favorite movies. And yeah, I did a video about the album Yellow Submarine, but I'm very attached to that. And just at a certain point, there was something about like when I was entering my preteen times. So I have all these older brothers. I have three older brothers, and one of them was in a rock band, actually two of them at that point. And so like I knew rock and roll was cool, and I wanted to be like them. And so first it was Hendrix. Like I just got into everything Hendrix, just everything Hendrix. And then it was the Beatles. And, you know, just looking back at it, I had a sort of a weird view of it. I was very interested in like what drugs they did and how much drugs they did, even though I've been straight edge, never done a drug my entire life. Like I was like fascinated by that. I don't really know. You know, I sort of know why, but it's a whole big psychological reason. And you know, it's funny because my whole life people have called me a contrarian, but it's like I'm a Star Wars collector and the Beatles are like maybe my favorite band. So how much of a contrarian can I be when the two major things that our civilization has produced, and now hip hop, you know, so like the three best things our society produced in the last 100 years. Yeah. So, you know, that was basically it. Like I just got, I bought all their albums on tape, and then I bought all their albums on CD, and not all of them. Like I still, the early stuff, I'm still not super familiar with. And I eventually came to appreciate the early stuff. And it's funny because when you talk about a band that's as loved as the Beatles, like, or the Rolling Stones, as I recently discovered, or Bob Dylan, it's terrible because the more loved they are, the more angry people are when you say anything bad about them. So I don't know if you've experienced that with anything you've said about the Beatles, but just be prepared for that. Because if you say something like Taxman isn't really that good of a song, like, people will be like, who's this guy think he is? And yeah, it's...
Hey, I already think I'm a piece of shit anyway before. So like, there's nothing I can say. I guess, like, I want to hear your perspective though on what to you makes them so great. Like, what to you makes the Beatles such a one of the best bands of all time?
Well, it's weird because so much of it just seems random that four people from the same town, like a relatively small city, born around the same time, could do something so amazing. And it really is, it's the individual and the collective that makes them so amazing. So it's like the fact that John and Paul's songwriting style is so different, and even their voice is so different, you know, that like that John is just, he's like, you know, the metallic taste of blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's his voice to me. Like, that it's that kind of like feeling. And then Paul is just the sweetest, like, you know, honey on toast, you know, and like, just, that's just their natural voices. But then it actually follows up like with their songwriting. And you see that in Revolver super well, that how delineated their songwriting is. And then like George to always be the little kid, you know, he's the youngest one. He's always feeling out of sorts. He's always trying to get his music on there. And like in any other band, he would be like one of the greatest songwriters of the 60s, but he happened to be stuck with two of the greatest songwriters of all time. So you're like, you have all that kind of energy. And then just, you know, Ringo, and I'm a drummer and I love simple drummers who are good. And he just does that. And especially on Revolver, I mean, his drumming is so good. I was re-listening to it again, and it's just so tasteful and so good. And you know, they managed to do, it's kind of, I mean, I guess it's sort of like a genius thing, you know, like of just experiencing genius. Like when I realized that when they wrote all this stuff, they were younger than you. Right. And like, you're the youngest person I know, you know what I mean? Like, but you know, like, and I have a baby, you know, like it's insane that they were able to write such varied music in such a short period of time with such intensity and such like creativity. Like the number of things that they pioneered just on such a consistent basis, like, you know, on this album, like the first backwards anything, you know, and just like really bringing in tape loops and all the Indian stuff and the rhythms and the themes. And it was just, but I mean, pretty just most simply, it's just, I just think they're great songs. You know, like I really enjoy it. It's, I'm not like, you know, I'm not like, I even consider myself to be a super fan of the Beatles, because like Beatles super fans are like, it's rough. Like, you know, like they're really into it, you know, like you really have to know, you know, which Gretsch is used on which song, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think really to simplify it, they make good music.
Whoa, shit. Part of my initial just hang up was I live in the 2010. I was living in the 2010s and the 2020s. And I remember like when I watched, and I like classic things, but like I remember when I watched like the Simpsons 20-year anniversary like documentary special they put out. I watched that live. I was such a big Simpsons fan at the time. And they interviewed Seth MacFarlane. And Seth MacFarlane was like, you know, on our show, we have these horrible jokes about blah, blah, blah. But on The Simpsons, oh boy, when Bart told Homer to shut up, that was pretty rad. Like, you know, it's like, so like the evolution is like now when you hear like a backwards tape, it's so cliche and like, oh, but brother, this again. But right. Like at this time, this must have like blown people's gourds and stuff. Like it must have been like the most And the fact that they did it in like such a short span of time, 7 years, like I didn't realize how prolific they were. Like they put out, when you look at a picture of them, like when they started, when they finished, they look like they aged right. like 30 years and stuff right, like yeah. that, you know?
I mean, that's, I mean, when we think about like Revolver and what makes it so good, when you hear people talk about it in particular, they just say, well, it was the most time off they had since 1962. So they had 3 months off. That was the most they hadn't worked.
Wow.
Since 1962, you know, because that's the other thing is that like when we talk about why are the Beatles so good, it's like they were in a boot camp. Like they were in the early days, they were like playing like 15 shows a week or something crazy like that, high off their ass on speed and just like flying at a million hours a minute, just like, you know, like whatever, like in a video game, like grinding, you know what I mean? Like they were grinding as a band to create something so amazing, which is probably why when they did start recording and making music, it was just like they could just do so much because they had this ease. The wild thing that I was saying, getting back to your original question, why do I like them so much? Because I love individual artists, you know, it's great. I love the individual and I can always tell when it's John or when it's Paul and it's different, right? But the fact that they were able to do that while very clearly benefiting so much from working together, it's just like this just amazing relationship.
Yeah.
And they had the 3 months to make it. And the other, I mean, I think a more fun way to think about it is they're just like, because part of the reason I love Revolver is the conversation, the sort of transatlantic conversation between Paul and Brian Wilson. So that came to me much later, you know, because I didn't listen to Pet Sounds till I was in college. But it you can see it. Like you can see Rubber Soul comes out and Brian Wilson loses it and makes Pet Sounds. And then it's not necessarily like that directly led to Revolver because some of it was recorded before and after, but still you can tell the way the Beatles went that there's this like awesome arms race of just like, how can we take this art form and just explode it into all these different ways? And it's, you know, it's exciting. You know, it happened way before I was born, you know, way, way before you were born, before I was born, yeah. But it's so great that we have a record of it. So
I would love it if you could like walk us through the background of this album a little bit, like what led to this point and like what made it so revolutionary.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say, because so I have done a lot of research on the Beatles in the past, but I decided I'd brush up and I was hanging out on my baby. And so I watched some YouTube videos to freshen up and it was all fine. It's all stuff that I knew before. And then I found this book, which is one of the better books about the Beatles, Revolution in the Head by Ian MacDonald. And I was reading it today and I was like, son of a bitch. The YouTube video I was watching was copying this word for word, just reading out of it and didn't give him any credit at all. So,
wow.
So Beatles Bible, you are on blast because that is just low. So I was like, this is a really good YouTube video. This is really well researched. Yeah. Because, yeah. So, and that's my favorite kind of, there's another book called Beatles in the Studio. And then this, any kind of Beatles book that will take you through the recording process, you can learn so much. That's why the documentary from last year was so good about the recording Let It Be. Cause like, that's how you learn everything really about them. It's not so much about like, who are they married to, but like, how do they interact in the studio? So when you kind of study the way they did it, you know, so they had time off, and basically the way to think about it is that we have like three songwriting geniuses that are starting to go off in slightly different directions. And that all comes through in the music. So like, so, you know, we got Paul and you know, Paul is like trying to make classical music. If you actually listen to what he's writing on here, he's doing like a poo-poo platter. He's just like, I'm going to give you a show tune. I'm going to give you a Motown tune. I'm going to give you a classic tune. He's just like basically styling on everybody. Like seriously, like look at all these different things I can do. And then John is just like, I'm just super into acid. Just really, really, really big fan of acid. But I think that's too simple because he's also doing a little bit of his like bitter stuff, you know? It's like, we're starting to get that, like, I'm too nice. I'm too mean. Like you're starting to get that kind of stuff. And like, and then George is just like going into the Indian stuff. But then the Indian stuff is getting into the rest of it. Like the rest of the music is starting to play with these drones. They're starting to be influenced by it. And I just to have Ringo there. Hi, I'm Ringo. he's playing great drums. But Yeah. So that's what's seen. And if you listen to Rubber Soul, you can feel them sort of going that way. And by the time you get to Sgt. Pepper, you know, you're really in the point where they're just doing a lot more songwriting completely apart from each other, which is how they're going to end their career, which is, you know, the music is still great, right? But it's not like them hanging around a hotel room being like, what if I did this? So they got together and they recorded it in Abbey Road. But the funny thing about where they recorded is that it was just garbage. Like, they talk about it in the Let It Be documentary, but they were the biggest band in the world, and where they recorded was not at all up to snuff. And it was written about in this book that, you know, the Rolling Stones at this point, they recorded in LA. They're like, we can't deal. Like, England is this little podunk country that doesn't know how to do engineering. And the Beatles never did that. They always stayed in just these pathetic things, which I think is part of what gives it its strength, is that there's an atmosphere and a feeling, like, especially if you hear the way some of the drums are recorded and just the sound, like, there's a rawness to it that, you know, you just can't be imitated. Probably my favorite thing that I was reminded of doing research for this is that the first song that they recorded, do you know this? The first song they recorded for the album?
No, I don't know.
Tomorrow Never Knows. So the absolute freak out song that represents the biggest shift in the entire album, the thing that everyone heard it and went, oh, okay, so psychedelia is a thing now. Sounds good. Let's have that.
Yeah.
That was the first song. So that totally recontextualizes the album, because it's played last. When they released the songs to the public, they held that one back because they knew it was going to freak people out, because it's just nothing sounds like that, right?
Yeah.
But that was how they started. So I think it helps you to see that, like, that wasn't the end of everything. It was the beginning, and then they filled in everything else.
The thing I did want to share from my previous episode that I thought was, like, really and, like, what one of my hangups at the time was, there seemed to be like different. And I, like, now listening to this, I, like, feel like this is actually accurate and stuff. Like, there seem to be, like, different modes of Beatles songs, whereas, like, they're, like, the compilation songs, the undeniable masterpieces, like, you could put on a Best of Beatles playlist, and, like, it's, like, on a Spotify playlist, it would be, like, this is music, this is songs,
right?
Like, the best, like, the baseline best songs of all time. And then they're the avant-garde, druggy-inspired songs. And then the songs are teeny boppers, like Hold My Hand and stuff.
Right.
Songs that could have been written for Monty Python, songs that could have been written for the Wiggles. And then there'd be, like, overlap. Like, sometimes, like, Yellow Submarine could have been written for the Wiggles. It's also kind of like a druggy song. It's also a masterpiece song at the same time. Right. Yeah, like, why does this work? Like, why does it all work? I don't understand, you know?
Yeah, I mean, now you're starting to get it, like, that question, like, how does it all work? How do these disparate, I mean, you just, you know, you take the first three tracks where you have, you know, Taxman, which is like a rocker, and then Eleanor Rigby, which is, it's so funny because, like, I listen to all these songs so much, I never even thought, like, when someone told me there's no guitar or bass or drums in Eleanor Rigby, I didn't even know that. I knew all the words. I could sing the song. Like, I just heard the song. I wasn't thinking, wow, what a brave move, right? And then right into I'm Only Sleeping, like, and then Love You Too, like, all the sitar, just on the first, like, you're just, it really is, you're going to, like, all these different places so quickly and all over the place. But yeah.
To go back to your Drake video, like, that you did, like, there is, like, this, like, it's one, in that case, it's, like, one guy, but, like, it's, like, when I listen to a Drake album, like, there are 23 tracks or whatever, I'm, like, okay, like, each song, I'm, like, it's not like I'm going to go like, oh, Drake starts here, then he ends here. Like, oh, he's whatever. It's like, what Drake am I going to get this song? Am I going to get the weird incel Drake? Am I going to get, like, yes, hard bars Drake? Am I, like, and it's like, it jerks you back and forth. And it's like such a, I think that was like a negative part of this experience. Like, the negative part of this experience initially was, like, the songs I really gravitated to and, like, was able to grasp were the Paul songs, where it was like, oh yeah, like, I do like being in love. Like, oh yeah, I do. Like,
right.
Or the songs that are, like, super simple and stuff. And then, but the fact that it would just, like, kind of jerk you back and forth. Yeah, I don't know. It's, like, so, it's so weird to me. So yeah.
I think too, it is an age thing as well, because like, or just exposure, right? So I had the right kind of exposure to the Beatles, where they were ubiquitous in my house, but it was in a positive way. So I loved them. So their ubiquity in culture wasn't oppressive at all, right? Like, I couldn't imagine not having grown up with Star Wars and the Beatles, just to take two simple examples, and try to interact with those things, you know, like Wizard of Oz, like, it's fine. Like, it's neat. It's a cool movie. Like, that's my attitude towards Wizard of Oz. And some people, it's like they grew up with it. It's the most important thing in their life. It's that whole thing, you know, like, so I do have sympathy, because it must be terrible being confronted with this massive thing of work, whatever. I have Shakespeare right above me on the bookshelf. It's the same kind of idea. It's just like,
I feel the same. Yeah. I mean,
like King Lear's, I think it was great. It's just, what am I supposed to say? Jeez.
I have a take here that's like kind of fun, kind of interesting. It's an album about nothing, you know, kind of like the same way Seinfeld's a show about nothing. Like, what's Seinfeld about? It's about nothing. Like, what happens in the show? Like, Seinfeld gets a puffy shirt, like Elaine gets a gun, Kramer does something crazy and stuff like that. Like, it, like, there isn't like a point of view or like a moral that Larry David's trying to give to you and go like, this is the point of view. Like, it's just about like four selfish people making lives worse and making insipid observations about everyday life. And it's like the most like brilliant
show. You're talking about Seinfeld, not the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like, they're not that selfish. I mean, insipid.
Like, the Beatles has like this, like a more positive spin on that idea. Like, you could imagine Taxman being like a Jerry Seinfeld routine. Like, what's the deal with taxes? Like, they, you know, like, when you die, declare the pennies on your eyes. And like, like, that's like kind of like a Jerry Seinfeldian thing. Like, Eleanor Rigby's about like two like nobody characters that like are sad and stuff like that. Like, I'm only sleeping is about John Lennon, like, loving sleep. And Here, There, and Everywhere is like about doing nothing with your partner. Like, Good Day Sunshine's about like just going to the beach with your partner. Like, it's all of this, all these things are like, when I listened to Abbey Road, I heard them go, the love you make is equal to the love you take. I was like, what? Like, yes. I was like, that's nothing. Yeah, that doesn't mean
that wins the Yoda Award for that doesn't mean anything. That's just, it's, I hate it when people make a big deal out of that line. It's like, that's like the laziest like public speaking. Like, and in the end, the love you take is equal to love you make, or the other way around. Either way, I'm deep, right?
Yeah. And like, there's songs about like doing drugs, which is like, I guess, a spiritual experience, but at the same time, you're kind of doing nothing at the same time. Like, it's about nothing. It's about, which I think is what people like about it. I think that's what people like. It's like about the bliss of just like being a person and like experiencing things and like slowing down, especially after you were talking about them grinding and them being like ground to a pulp and chasing stardoms, and like they're singing to an audience that's like screaming at them. So it becomes a non-enjoyable thing. And it's like, I think it ties with the artistic freedom that they're moving to rather than chasing hits and stuff like that. Right. And it somehow worked. And like the, like John Lennon's like, what if there was a song about being sleepy? And then like everyone's like, yeah, I guess that's a pop hit.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way to think about it, because their life also just biographically, their life had gotten really difficult because they were touring. That was how they made most of their money. But that was after they had said, I'm not saying we're better than Jesus, you know, that whole, the Jesus controversy happened and people were burning Beatles albums in America and they dissed the government in the Philippines, and so they were getting attacked over there. And so like they were really ending. I like the idea of the album being about nothing, and that's why it's interesting that it works that way. But then also, when you really understand who they are and where they were in their songwriting, like that's where it comes through, like the substance comes through. You know, take as an example, like let's just take George's journey on this album, right? So George has three songs. He normally only has two, and sometimes just one. The first song, Taxman, I argue is maybe the worst song off the best album. Like in terms of difference between, I like the song, but it's to me, it's not up to snuff for the rest of it. but it's a right-wing song. He's complaining about paying for taxes. You know, I mean, this isn't like a metaphor for drugs. This is literally when you make enough money in England, it was 19 cents on the 19 out of 20 cents went to the government, and he was 23 years old. So like, it's a weird thing that like rock stars in England really weren't super rich. Like they just could not be because of all the people that had their hands in their pockets and all that. So you have this really materialistic song, and they even Mr. Heath is a reference to a conservative politician. So they made sure that it couldn't just be seen as anti-labor party, mm-hmm. but like, and then the rest of the album, his other songs are all like, we're just people. We don't need to hold on to things. We need, you know, like it's I want to tell you. Yeah. It's, I want to tell you, it's love you too. It's all the Indian lack of self stuff. So he's simultaneously on the same album talking about the need to have oneness with the universe and just be ethereal beings, not attached to this terrible flesh. And then he's like, they made me pay for my Rolls Royce and I want to be richer than I am.
Yeah.
So like, you know, he's a 23-year-old guy who's writing these three. It's like incomprehensible that he's 23 and he'd already been this famous for 4 years anyways. And the same thing with Paul, where like, I mean, definitely his stuff wasn't that much because he was just trying to keep doing what he was doing and build on what Brian Wilson was doing as well. And just like, I am going to be the great songwriter and I'm going to know how to write this kind of song and this kind of song. And this is our Motown song and I'm going to write the best Motown song ever. And here it is, you know, so there is an emptiness there, but the substance is somebody really trying to show that he can write music. Cause mm-hmm. sort of before then the band in general, the way people think of it is it was more John focused. And this was the point where it became a lot more Paul focused for better or worse. And then just John, yeah, it's about sleeping, but also he's like suffered with depression and also he's serious substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's sort of a depressing, I mean, it's depressing, right? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you know somebody who sleeps too much, like, it could be a modern song, you know, just like, mm-hmm. oh my God, man, are you okay? I'm only sleeping. Yeah, right. So yeah, so I agree with your take and I disagree with it at the same time.
No. I think like that's like at the end of the initial conversation in Seinfeld where like George pitches the show to Jerry. Jerry says, now that's something, you know, like that's like
right.
when you triangulate and like when you like zoom into like these what could be seen as like these like nothing experiences and these nothing lives. It's like very important. It's like, why should we not consider the humanity of Eleanor Rigby and Father McKenzie, these people who society views as nobodies and they didn't right. accomplish anything meaningful? Like, why should we not like look at them and view their humanity, view their human spirit and stuff like that? The fact that they wake up every morning and try to do something is really right. wonderful. And like,
that's one of the things I talk about a lot on the channel, because I think it's an important thing that isn't communicated very clearly, you know, is the importance of social realism in art. And that's what's funny is you have Taxman as the first track, which is a capitalist screed about not wanting to give the government money so that, you know, poor people get health insurance. Right. And then the second song is, you know, that's what social realism is. It's describing people who are not glamorous, who are living a hardscrabble life, you know, like, and that's exactly what he's doing. And it has all the lush strings and it's sort of like a hymn to the forgotten people. And there was a period of time where I hated this song because I thought the chorus was just so preachy. Just, oh, look at all the lonely people, you know, just like, oh my God, Brittany, look at all the lonely people. It's kind of, but when you really listen to it, it's beautiful. It's simple. It tells a story.
Yeah. And then like, if we're talking about George, like in Taxman, like kind of like contrasting Eleanor Rigby, it's like we see the social realism of this guy, like this superstar who like wants to be like this enlightened kind of guy, but is that also like concerned about his like, and pissed off about his taxes. And like, there's a little part of me that's like, hey man, I get it. Like, they're annoying. And like, you know,
especially, you know, 19 cents out of 20. That's insane. Like that, you know, he's not, there was an actual complaint to make. And that's where we're sort of getting into sort of maybe the way stars are now, like especially rap stars will sometimes complain about things where you're like, how can you possibly be complaining about that? You know, when it's such problems of wealth, you know, whatever, like the joke on the new Drake album, you know, the personal chef made me the same meal twice in a row, you know, but there is a humanity in being like, hey, we can all relate to not wanting to pay taxes. And yeah.
Or just like, hey man, I work so hard and like government took 19 out of 20, you know, things. And it's like, yeah, like I get it. Like it's, but at the same time, I'm like unsympathetic to him at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And like also aggravated by him, like in the other song where I'm like, what you were just talking about this, you know?
Yeah.
Any other themes of this album, any other kind of macro things about this record? Like, I guess we could like kind of talk by song, like some of the songs, but like, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we probably go song by song. The main macro thing I would say is just that the how we're seeing the songwriters becoming the songwriters they'll become, even though there's other great John songs and Paul songs and George songs. Maybe not George. I think George is definitely the one who improved the most as time went on
because
he had a little more time to mature. So yeah, I think it's more, I think that's the main macro way. I mean, even the title Revolver is sort of a forgettable title. I mean, they say it's just because a record goes around. I always thought it was because they use a lot of speakers that revolve, you know, to make like the whirling sounds. But yeah. And then the fact that John was killed by someone with a revolver just always makes me dislike the title. It's the worst title for a great album. I can say that much.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. hey everybody, welcome back to the show. We're here to talk about, you know, Revolver by the Beatles. Let's go through highlight songs first. Like it's going to be mostly highlights. But Sky, what's a highlight song for you?
Well, only because I heard someone, one of the YouTubers I was hearing talking about this album saying that And Your Bird Can Sing was a forgettable song that no one likes. I was like, what the hell are you talking about? I love that song. And in particular, if you don't know, they just released like a mega version of Revolver with like two extra discs of outtakes and everything. Mm-hmm. And so it's on Spotify and everything. You don't have to buy the $400 album. And it's awesome because you can hear early versions of And Your Bird Can Sing and the rhythm is just all messed up. It's just totally boring. It just doesn't work at all. And it's fascinating to see how it really developed. So yeah, And Your Bird Can Sing is, as far as like the guitars, the singing, the bizarreness of the lyrics. Like I've never understood the lyrics. I've read interpretations of it. It that sort of has this exuberance and this joy to it. I'm like, wait, people don't like that song. So yeah, that's a definite highlight.
Speaking of like exuberance and joy, like, I think Good Day Sunshine is like the song that is like that. Like it's not really like, again, it's like kind of like a nothing song about just like going to the beach with your girlfriend and stuff like that, having a good time. Yeah. And like, it could be seen as like very like insipid, but at the same time, it's like, it just like, I like truthfully, like I'm like a relatively anxious person and I put a lot of work into this show, but I get like a lot of anxiety, like trying to come up with like things and stuff like that. But yeah, it's like this song and like Good Day Sunshine and then like Here, There, Everywhere. I listen to it and like some of that anxiety just like lifts like vapor and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember my dad, I was on a road trip with my dad and I played Sweetener by Ariana Grande and he reacted like really positive to, like, he usually doesn't listen to any music. He listens to, you know, Cat Stevens, like he listens to Keith Green and stuff like that. And he listens, just like the energy of that song. He literally just said something along the lines of, this song is making me happy. It's like, it was that.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
Good Day Sunshine was that for me. It's just like, and I could see how it's very inspired by the Beach Boys, how it's very just like, oh, wow. Like you're the kind of the fun competition of like the like, oh, I'm gonna take what you did and then improve on it and stuff like that, that they were in the middle of, is like so cool.
And to get back to your earlier question about what makes the Beatles so great, that's a great example. It's a fun song, it's catchy and it's cool, but then when you like really listen to it, it's just painful how well produced it is. Just like how exciting, like when you think about just the melody and just how they decided to record everything, the pounding of the beginning and like the blaring sounds. And then just when it just cuts out to like the junky piano that just sounds a little bit out of tune. And it's just like all those things went into this just silly little ditty song that is just, and that's that great thing that the Beach Boys are able to do too, where you're just like, oh, this is just this fun thing. And then you listen to it and you just want to weep. It's like, it's so beautiful. It's like a sunset, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, cause like we all like have these feelings of, you know, sadness or joy or whatever. But to be able to putting like that feeling onto like a piece of paper, like it doesn't, no words can like, unless you're truly gifted or unless you truly work at it, like you can't fully translate it, but like something like this, like you're able to translate that pure, simple joy of this beat, this fun beach day, this memory that you have. And then you're just like, oh man, remember that? That was the best, one of the best days of my life. And it was so simple. And then translating into this song is so wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's crazy. This whole album is just so filled with songs that I think are amazing. I think, you know, she said is like the fact that that ends side A and then side B starts with Good Day Sunshine, because she said is like one of the most depressing songs, you know, just because John was an absolute misogynist, asshole, terrible person to his partners, and it's just the bitterness. Remember, I was talking about like the voice being like the metallic taste of blood, like that's just totally there. And when you listen to the demo that's on the deluxe edition that just came out, you know, it's still there. It's just him and a guitar. You just can't believe it. And like, that's like the John songwriting. That's just so great. There's just that sharpness to it. And to have that right next to Good Day Sunshine, it just exists perfectly. Just like, I know what it is to be dead. Or as he said in an earlier version, and you're making me feel like my trousers are torn. Cause you know, he's always goofing around. And especially coming. So like she says right there in between Good Day Sunshine and Yellow Submarine, which is just wild. It's hard because Yellow Submarine is, you know, like my mom used to sing that song to me when I was a baby. I sang that song at my wedding, like with a guitar and stuff. Like, wow. I've played it for all my kids, you know, before bedtime, just hanging around the house. You know, I know it's not a video podcast, but I brought my Lego Yellow Submarine here. You know, it manages to do like everything that I love that the Beatles do. Plus it's a great kid's story. And this is just one little thing I'll add that I learned from really listening to the opening section. The demos. So John's demos of Yellow Submarine is him just playing the chords. It says, you know, C, D, C, G, just very simple. And instead of, it's in the town where I was born, no one cared, no one cared. In the place where I was from, no one cared, no one cared. It's this like lo-fi, seriously, it could come out like tomorrow and be like, because, you know, and that's just where he was. Like, that was his attitude and his expression. And then he mixes it together and you hear later stages of the recording and Paul's there and they're writing the song. And then it's this great collective joy where we're all singing together.
But like, that's the thing I like about, like, you're talking about like the perfect, like this is the perfect configuration of like, they're all together. They all like each other. They're all like the splintering of the tastes are still kind of in line with each other. Like John isn't too bitter yet. And like, whatever. It's like, again, this is like literally like 3-4 years later since they started.
It's insane.
So crazy how much like someone can change in like so little time. But like, it's also like, you know, there's like this Chris Rock joke in like his special where he talks about the tambourine, where it's like in a marriage, like you're either the lead singer or the tambourine player. And like, you better like play that. Like if you're playing the tambourine, you can't go like proud and like be pouty about it. You're like, John is like, yeah, we're singing about a Yellow Submarine. I mean, like, that sounds great. It's like Will, like Will Ferrell used to do this too. That had this quality too, when like the shittiest sketch, like Will Ferrell would commit his like 100% to that.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's like kind of that joy too, of just like the joy I get with my co-host too. Just like, wow, like this is the which is like why I was like a little bummed, like, oh man, I would have loved this guy to see this a little bit. But like, it's like kind of like that, like, that joy is like so like makes it greater than the sum of its parts. I love Eleanor Rigby. I think that's like my big highlight. All the Paul songs I certainly gravitate to the most. I think he might be my favorite member this time around. Like, I think when I listened to Abbey Road, like it was George, because I love Here Comes the Sun and stuff. It's like really deceptively simple. But like there's like it's like a tone pull and quality to it, where it's like wearing the face she kept in a jar by the door, who's it for? And then darning the socks in the night when there's nobody there, what does he care? Like, there's a little bit of like complexity like to that, where it's like, what does that mean? There's like first of all there's the what does it mean quality to it, and then there's also the it's simple enough where you could understand it the first time, but it's something you kind of keep turning in your head over and over again. And also just like the uniqueness of like, why did he say it like that is really fun, really wonderful.
That's a great point. Cause when I was a kid, you know, and I loved that, I knew all the songs. I literally thought that she kept like science fiction, that she kept a face in a jar by the door. Like, I thought she didn't have a face when she was at home and she put on her face. I didn't know what darning a sock was. I thought he was like yelling at his socks. Like, I had this whole funny kid vision of what the song was about. I didn't know why there was rice at the church.
You're stupid back then.
Totally. It was so funny. And you know, and because of that, that's like the profundity of the song has always escaped me a little bit, because, you know, it's, you know, wearing the face in the jar by the door, you know, like the person's putting on a fake face, you know, like there is an interesting undercurrent of like this album is also dealing with a lot with depression. Because between Eleanor Rigby and I'm Only Sleeping, those are two different kinds of depression, you know, like putting on a fake face and just kind of walking through life and being lonely and then just wanting to sleep all the time.
Yeah. And then just like, yeah. And also like depression and like loneliness are just like I imagine they're on the road and like they have like meet screaming fans all the time, but they're probably like, and even within the group, they probably feel a little lonely, especially because they're like splintering off and stuff. Yeah. And yeah, I feel this song a lot though. Like, I think, first of all, like this idea that like there are people out there who just like live and die and no one, like, they're not like their lives aren't as like documented or cared about as much as like Paul McCartney or something like that. And like, there's a part of me that's like, oh man, that's like my personal nightmare of just like, I have like this podcast that's on the internet and no one gives a shit. And like, I put so much effort into it. And like, I try, I invite all these cool guests and like work so hard, because if I don't work hard at it, then I'm going to be forgotten. Then I'm not going to like break through the ceiling of the algorithm or whatever. And I won't be seen and my life won't matter. Like, that's like a real fear I have. And then like when I'm depressed, I'm like, why put all this extra effort in this thing that's not being opened by the world? But like, it's at the same time, it's like a celebration of the human spirit. Like, man, like, you know, this guy, Father McKenzie, he's like, he's doing this because like, because it's like important to him and because he wants to, you know, save people. He wants to do this, all that stuff. Yeah. It's like, and I don't know, there's also a realism, social realism. Like, yeah, we all die though, you know, no matter who you are at the same time. I think this song is so wonderful and does so much in so little space.
And the other thing to add too, is just that the Beatles had George Martin, and that's the other thing that is what made them so transcendently good. So they had an older person in their life who really knew recording and really knew classical music, who could help them achieve their goals. And he wasn't a hanger-on. He wasn't some studio guy. He was somebody that they trusted, probably more than they trusted each other even, because he was like kind of older, kind of father, you know, avuncular kind of guy. So, you know, he's doing the arrangements for Eleanor Rigby. You know, Paul doesn't know how to do those yet. You know, so he's just kind of all over this album and all like the crazy, trippy stuff that they did on Sgt. Pepper's and that they do here. I mean, to be honest, like, it's all reminded me of the whole Kanye thing, you know, like Kanye has a great idea and then he has to find someone who can do it. Like the Beatles would have these great ideas. And often it would just be this old guy just being like, I mean, I think he was like 32 or something, but he was old to them.
Old.
You know? he, when you look it up, he was like surprisingly
wizened old crone.
You know, he was like the guy who could figure it out. So that's another great aspect of it is not only are they growing as songwriters, but they're learning how to use George Martin in a better way.
Any other highlights that we obviously
I mean, I'm just gonna kind of keep going through them. I mean, I think for no one is one of my favorite Paul songs. I guess because it isn't as played as the rest of his sort of big emotional hits. But especially the French horn solos. You know, my son played French horn and it's a beautiful instrument. And I don't, if you don't know this out there listening, it's one of the hardest instruments you can possibly play. It is extremely difficult to play a French horn. And it's just this beautiful little moment in there. And it's the way that he's describing a lost love. Like, I hate it when really rich, powerful, successful people can describe human emotions so well sometimes because it's just unfair. It's like, Paul, what the hell do you know? You were one of the most famous people in the world by the time you were 22. What do you know about Cried for No One? You know, and so I guess I can see I'm still not done with all my highlights.
No,
I
think I want to
tell you is my George highlight. Mainly because the dissonance that's in the piano lines, the tempo, 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 like there's a movement to that song that's just so awesome. Tomorrow Never Knows has traditionally been my favorite song off the album, but that's probably because it was the most druggy and I was so fascinated by that. But I'm trying to think, like, what is Ringo's best performance? I think Ringo's best performance is actually She Said, She Said.
Okay.
But then I would say the second best is Tomorrow Never Knows. And that's another plug for the bonus features on the Super Deluxe Edition. Because there's a version of Tomorrow Never Knows where the rhythm is just straight. So it's not boo-ga-da-boo-ga. It's just like boo-boo-ga-boo-boo-boo-ga-boo. And the whole song just doesn't jump at all. there's no amount of hallucinogenics that make that work. So yeah, I think I'm done with all my highlights there.
No, I didn't mean to like rush you through them and stuff like that. No. I was like, yeah,
it's great.
I love for No One paired with Here, There, Everywhere. Like it's kind of the ephemeral quality of Here, There, Everywhere. Like there's of love and just like in so little time describing like kind of like the delusion and the dependency you feel where like you hope it's mutual, even if you're not physically present with them, love is something you carry here, there, everywhere. And it's just like kind of like this mutual delusion you share with like a person and like you look in each other's eyes and go, oh, wait, you believe in love forever? I believe in love forever. I love you forever. Okay, let's try this. And then to pair that with For No One, it's like what you talk about all the time is like the death of the ideal, the death of the potential. Yeah. And then he can tell it's over from the look of her eyes of like, there's nothing there. And in the same, like he's looking for that like, wait, I believe this. And then I'm seeing in your eyes that you don't believe this anymore. And it's like this, the sadness and grief of that death of that potential like follows you here, there, everywhere also.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, that's nice having those paired together. I hadn't really thought of that, but they do really go well together. Another fun thing about Here, There, and Everywhere is that like John and Paul at different times said that they're their favorite Beatles songs. And like John doesn't, you know, usually he'll often kind of slag off on Paul's songs. So like the fact that Paul loved Here, There, and Everywhere just upsets my understanding of John because it feels like maybe he wasn't as grumpy as people think, because it's such a beautiful, sweet song. And it's sort of the opposite of what we think of as a John style song. So the fact that he just loved that song and the sweetness. But no, I really like that idea, though, what you were saying about Here, There, and Everywhere and For No One, that that's on the same album by the same person. It's,
yeah,
it's very, yeah, it's an amazing, it's kind of like the dichotomy of Taxman and Love You Too, just the yeah, that kind of distance.
Let's go through lowlights then. What's a lowlight for you? Who cares?
What's interesting about it is, you know, we're talking 66. So, I mean, LSD wasn't even really like, I mean, it was in, you know, whatever, the Grateful Dead were doing acid tests and people knew about acid, but it wasn't the thing it would become. And so the idea of like writing a love song to your drug dealer, which is essentially what it is. I mean, he's not a drug dealer. He was like, it's a story about an actual guy who is in New York who would dose people's coffee with weird drugs and stuff. It's just, I don't know. I mean, it's a great song, right? Because it's weird, because it becomes like a church hymn or something in the middle, right? Like it gets.
I do like that.
You're feeling.
I love that. Like, that's good.
But more than any other song, it feels as though it is the Beatles telling kids you need to do drugs. Like the most important thing you can do is drugs. And eventually John is going to have to cut back on acid because he's doing so much acid. You know, there was a real chance that we would have lost him, like, you know, Sid Barrett style. Like he was just totally lost on it. And yeah. So yeah, Dr. Robert's definitely a low light. Taxman is such a low light that I kind of like it. It's always bugged me because I've never known, like, it has nothing to do with the song, with the Batman theme, you know, Batman. But when I was a kid, I always thought it was the same song anyways. And I think Love You Too.
Batman would sing about this, though. Like, I think this would be Batman's favorite song. Like,
it's like, true. Bruce Wayne hates Taxes.
Other than like Something in the Way by Nirvana, like this one. I think he'd like.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think really Love You Too and Dr. Robert, those are, I think, are the two weakest ones. I mean, Love You Too is fine, and I like how it's kind of headed towards the Indian stuff. But in general, like I don't love the Indian stuff. I think it's interesting. Yeah. And then also there's the whole post-colonial aspect of it, which has only come to mind in the last couple of years or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't hear
people talk about that really that much.
No, you don't. How weird is it? You know, a bunch of British people are hanging around in England. I mean, in India, and like taking their culture. But you know, they did so much to popularize it that I don't think they're culture vultures. But they sure as hell would be called it now. It'd be very Drake. Drake comes out with the sitar album. Yeah, yeah.
That makes me feel a little uncomfortable. Like this, that whole bit, like, and just like him doing his Indian thing is like very strange to me. Like, and it's also just like not that interesting either. Like, I don't think he's like saying anything that like. Profound with like Love You Too necessarily.
Yeah.
I again, like, the part I do like is the showing the hypocrisy, which shows the human being underneath it, which is cool. Dr. Robert, just like anytime they go into like this abstract, like just like this. I know he's like kind of based on a real guy, but in this song, he's kind of like a fictional guy. Like anytime, like they sing a song about Mr. McGorin's Magic Emporium, I'm like, I check out. Like, I'm like, yeah. I don't care about this. Like, this
you
is
don't
like
care about Paul Seed Pam. You don't care about Mr. Mustard.
Yeah, yeah. Like Mr. Kite or whatever his name is. Like, I don't really care about that. Like, it's just like too. It's so like. This one's like kind of grounded, but it's usually so out there and so abstract that I'm like, I don't know what to make of this. Like, I really don't like care about this. And like the fact that I can't grab onto like an emotional truth about humanity or something like that. I'm like, I don't care. Like, this is boring.
Yeah.
Any other observations, any other thoughts, any other things we haven't got through?
I don't think so. I mean, there is a neat thing, which I've only realized recently, that the album cover is done by Klaus Voormann. And Klaus Voormann is a guy who was actually hanging around with the Beatles back in Hamburg before they were big. And then he was a bass player on a lot of the Beatles solo albums, like across all of them. So he's sort of, it's fun having him do this album cover sort of in the middle of their career when he was there before it started, and then he was there after it ended. Just kind of this like random German scenester. I don't actually like the cover that much. Like it's fine. It's I don't think it's particularly visually agreeable, and always bugs me that it's not in color, because, you know, like I like my favorite albums to have color on them. But anyways,
the eyes freak me out. Of the drawings of the eyes and the real eyes, like, kind of freak me out too.
I think it's actually their actual eyes. Pictures of their actual eyes. Yeah, it's very uncanny. And I always thought it was, isn't it the Rolling Stones? There's like a little drawing. I swear that's Mick Jagger. I don't know. They kind of play around with that. But yeah, I mean, I think those are my main thoughts. It's fun because I haven't really tried to think about why is it my favorite beyond just that thing I was saying, that sort of middle point between the beginning and the end, which still ends up being true, but it's fun to put more nuance on it.
Yeah, like the John songs are like the most, like they're the growers for me. Like I didn't like them at first, and now I kind of like them. And now I imagine if I listen to them next, like I listened to Sergeant Pepper today also, and I was like, oh, this is really good. Like, I really like this a lot. But like she said it's like I woke up this morning and I listened to the album like two times yesterday, and I woke up this morning, and for some reason, she said was the song that was like stuck in my head. Not the immediately like, all the lonely people, like none of that. Like that was the one that really stuck in my head. And I'm like, oh, I guess there's something here. And then like, I'm Only Sleeping, I really like, because it's like, I don't know. I get it. Like I feel how he feels sometimes. Like I feel like, I like, I get 8 hours of sleep and I don't feel rested some days. And then also like, I get 8 hours of sleep and then I wake up and I like dread having to do things and stuff. And then,
it's also a good sort of, you know, anti-work kind of statement too, because the whole thing is essentially going back to one of the themes they keep touching on, the sort of fruitlessness of endeavor, you know, the fruitlessness of self, fruitlessness of work, of individuality, of all that stuff that I'm on, you know. They think I'm lazy. I don't care. I think they're crazy. It's a ridiculously dumb rhyme, but it's fairly simple that, you know, running around at such a speed. It's so funny too, because like now that I'm like really trying to focus on the lyrics, I've misheard so many lyrics. Like I always thought in Here, There, and Everywhere, it was with a flick of her hair, but it's a flick of her hand. But it's funny because he then says the word there. So hair rhymes with there. So I was, you know, controlling with a flick of her hair. Anyways,
so like let's get through final thoughts and ratings. The way this works is we'll rate this on a 10 with a fun metric at the end, and Sky, what's your thoughts on this?
So I have to rate it out of 10.
You could do whatever you could do. Yes. Like the thing you did last time, like Attack of the Clones out of 10.
Oh man, that was really good. It's a 10.
Yeah, there you go.
I could theoretically not dock points for Dr. Robert, but like, well, you know, there's no point. It's still a great song. All the songs on here, all the Beatles songs are like 2 or 3 minutes long. You're like, you can't believe how rich they get all the information in. It doesn't overstay. Yeah. So I would say that.
Yeah, I don't think there's such thing as a perfect album. Like even the albums I love, like, and like are my favorites, and like there's songs where I'm like, I don't like that very much. But if the highs accomplish something really special, then I think it gets a 10. I'm gonna give this 7.5 darned socks.
So, okay, like, 7.5 darned socks.
I really love. I think what it evolves into with Sergeant Pepper is more interesting to me. Like I think the dynamics of Day in a Life. I think this album basically with Sergeant Pepper, they changed how the album is constructed. And this, I feel it changed how pop music is constructed. And I think that's interesting. But like, to me, like if I had to pick one, I would choose Sergeant Pepper. So, and obviously I'm probably, I'm probably in the to any boomers or Xers or whatever who love the Beatles and stuff like that, who found out how to use an iPod or whatever.
Just like, yes.
Figured it out. Yeah, your grandson help you out. Right. Like, to any of those people, like I'll say to them, like, I'm probably wrong. I'm probably like, need to listen. Well, this is like, I've listened to this for a few days only, and I'm coming at it from a very different context.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are albums I love that didn't hit me the first time. So, like, and having to do this show where I have to, like, talk about it, like, is, like, challenging. So, yeah, So 7.5 Darn Socks. Like, there's some really, really high highs that I'll keep and, like, hold in my heart forever, that are just pretty undeniable. But, like, there's some songs that are just, like, super frivolous and don't, like, immediately, like, I remember super well. So, yeah, I'll give it that.
Okay, fair enough. Prepare yourself for all the hate comments.
Thank you so much, Sky. Like, I hope you had a nice time, like, on this show again. This is your fourth appearance. Like, your next appearance is going to be your... Wow. Your next appearance is going to be your Five Timers Club. So you could... Yeah, nice. Like, there's so many
Alec
opportunities.
Alec Baldwin, Tom Hanks.
We're going to get him on... There's a video, like, today of, like, Alec Baldwin, like, in a car going, like, all right, I got to talk about my favorite Woody Allen movies. that's pretty great. So yeah, we'll get him on a Zoom. Check out your other to the audience. I would highly recommend checking out your previous appearances on the show, the Kanye finale, the Ye tier list, the Life of Pablo episodes. Like, those are our most popular episodes we've ever done, and it's, like, really cool to, like, have the episodes I'm, like, really the most proudest of, like, be the most popular. That's, like, real such a treat. But yeah, like, Sky, what do you like to plug?
That's great, because my most popular video is still my Playboi Carti concert review, which is a good video of mine, but there are other videos I put a lot more effort into and I'm a lot more proud of. I'll plug my Prehistory of Daft Punk video, because that's the video that I put the most work in. I actually edited that thing. I don't think I've even gotten 1,000 views on that. I'm still bitter. That's what I would say. It's really fun coming on here and talking. There's sort of like, because I started doing my channel before ingesting any media about music, I had never heard of Fantano. I didn't really know what Pitchfork was, like, all that stuff. Like, I wasn't on Instagram, all that. It's fun, like, seeing what other people are doing. So, I really enjoy what you guys are doing. And then, you know, it's, I feel like it's a similar sort of appreciation. So yeah, my plug is for people to keep listening to your show and Professor Sky on YouTube. And if you like this podcast, in the comments, put APAA. It's an awesome podcast as always.
Subscribe and, on Spotify. Yes. Truly, like, this is like, you could like, it's a true honor that you like to come on this show. It's like, you could be on like Fantano every week if you wanted to, or like Sean, you could invite him every week and stuff like that. But like, it's really cool. So I appreciate it.
It's fun.
Yeah.
I'd be way too scared to be with Sean C.
Oh.
The guy is terrifying. If you ever see him interviewed, the guy puts up with no shit. I would just be, I don't mean that as a diss. That's a compliment.
Yeah. You can follow the show at IBMTLTT on Instagram and TikTok. You can follow me at Andrew Ambrose Lee on Instagram. You can follow Michael at Michael Lemon Taco on Instagram. You can follow Stenley at Snapasten on Instagram and Harper at Harping About on Instagram. Leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Subscribe on Spotify. Hit the smash the subscribe button. And Sky,
if I can be a hipster, I think it would be fun to have one of the demo version of She Said, She Said. Right. So that way people can kind of hear the rawness and how you feel like it was recorded in 2022, even though it's from 1966.
Wow. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Have a great day. All right.
Bye, everybody.
Hey, click.
All right, click, click.
And it's making me feel like my trousers are torn.